everybody. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every single day talking about HR with the folks that are making it happen out there. So let's get to our guest and welcome Christopher DeMars. Welcome to Drive Through HR.
Thank you very much. Exciting to be here.
Well, if you would, introduce yourself to our listeners, and we'll roll into our big question after that.
Wow. I am Christopher DeMars. I tweet a lot, and I post to LinkedIn a lot. You might know me as Christopher in HR. I am Chewy's best friend, and I have been doing HR for about 30 years.
Nice. Well, we're going to have all kinds of fun today, and I see you in my tweet stream all the time, and I appreciate, obviously, I appreciate everything you do there and retweeting content and things like that. Tell us what's top of mind for you these days. What's kind of keeping you up at night?
You know, what keeps me up at night, other than the inability of the Dallas Cowboys to be the great team that they really are.
Truth.
What keeps me up at night is the changing nature of the face of the workforce, if you will. I'm talking to lots of clients who are very interested in contract employees. They're very interested in consultants. They're very interested in virtual, contingent, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm noticing less and less over-enthusiasm for what we used to call the regular employee. And I think that's terrific that we're all becoming more adept and flexible. At the same time, I wonder if everybody's really thought through what does that do to the nature of the workplace relationship if we don't have an employer, but we have lots of, you know, engagements, if you will.
Yeah, and what's nice about that is like Elance and Odesk and the freelance nation, the folks that are contractors. How do you engage those folks? How do you bring them in? How do you, you know, not think of people as just full time or part time and kind of those rigid boxes, but how do we think of people that, you know what, 10 hours a week, 15 hours a week towards some highly valuable content or whatever, or outcomes? How do we interact with those folks? So I love this this story. Let me ask you, and I've been thinking a lot about this as boomers kind of get closer and closer and closer to kind of leaving the workforce. Is there a different Is there a different way that we should be interacting with boomers? Like, should we be thinking of them as fractional? Instead of getting boomers for 40 hours a week, maybe we should be interacting with them and getting 20 hours a week or 10 hours a week, et cetera?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, it's the epitome of the results-only work environment, right? I know plenty of people, especially in the recruiting space, which is where I got, you know, my real start, my primary love, if you will. But I know plenty of people in that space who would be happy to give you, you know, X number of hours a week or just work on an assignment and get paid on the completion of the assignment, if you will. But they don't want to be in your office. They don't want to go to your meeting. They're not bought into your, you know, environment per se. They're pursuing a craft, and they want to do that in a fairly limited way. And I think the forward-looking organizations out there have already deduced that, and they're already using those people. And it's, you know, it's the ultimate win-win, in my opinion.
What's succession look like for you? Have you interacted with succession or succession planning or succession management software very much in your career?
You know, I haven't used the software as much as I've gone through the process, and I can tell you it's really changed in the last, you know, 5 years for sure, but even 10 years if you take a longer view. You know, one of the things we used to be able to do was to predict, you know, succession needs based on the growth of the business and complexity of the business and, you know, generic success profiles or competency models and that sort of thing. What's happened over the last couple of years, you know, 2010 and beyond, is organizations are changing so rapidly from a practitioner point of view, and I do a lot of this, it's really hard for me to say with any accuracy what you're likely going to be needing in 2 or 3 years. What I can say now is you need people that are very adaptable, you know, fast learners, agile learners, if you will. So I haven't worried as much about the technology or the software as I've worried about, do you understand the nature of your work will change so dramatically that in as little as 36 months, you may not really know what you're looking for?
How do we screen, so on the selection side of talent, how do we screen those types of personalities in or out? And if we have them inside the box, how do we train them up, teach them up? Like, how do we teach adaptability?
I'm a firm believer that experience and doing is still the best learner. You know, it's a great example to me of the veracity of Pareto's law or the 80-20 analysis. You learn by doing in a semi-controlled environment, if you will, if I can make sure that the projects that you're involved with aren't so significant that they might bankrupt me, we can take a lot of risk and we can have a lot of failure. So that denotes or connotes an institutional understanding that we are going to learn by doing. That's terrific. Learning by doing sometimes means we make a left turn when we should have turned right. And that works as long as the participants in that experiment don't realize pain for having done so. So you get the institutional support mechanism in place, the willingness to try different projects, different tasks, rotational assignments, that sort of thing. And you learn very quickly who is, in fact, capable of this adaptiveness, this ability to shift from one mode to the next, to pick things up quickly, to put things down quickly. That's where I think you get the whole notion of, all right, do you embody and live flexibility, or is it just a language that you use periodically?
Is there a relationship for you between adaptability and performance, meaning maybe your all-stars aren't really all that adaptive? Maybe, you know, I'm thinking that in the context of like soccer, you know, your rover position, somebody that plays midfield, that runs around the field and plays a little bit of offense, plays a little bit of defense, they're fantastic, they're adaptive, but they're not scoring goals. You know, and that probably breaks down logically if you kind of extend that out to a lot of things. But what's, in your mind, what's the relationship between adaptive and performance?
I still don't think you can get away from results. It's an interesting question. I was just talking the other day with a couple of my colleagues. And, you know, the old school used to be results count, you know, get them however you need to get them. We can polish you up and buff off the rough edges, that sort of thing later on. I think thankfully we've advanced a little bit and we've realized, no, you know, it's the what and how in my lexicon. When I teach people, I say what and how are important. You know, what you do is maybe 80% of the game, the results that you're asking about, but how you do it is important. If in fact you're really good at learning new things and applying new technologies and picking up new systems, but you just can't get anything to completion, that's a concern for me. But I would never look at one versus the other, and I would start with what are the results we're after and then what's important to us in terms of getting the results, how do we want to protect and extend our culture while we're doing that.
All right, so I want to ask you a little bit about leadership styles and kind of organizational structures. You know, it's too easy to say, you know, there was this command and control. Now things are, tend to be flat or flatter or matrix or not, et cetera. You obviously have seen a lot and probably seen pros and cons along with a lot of these different types of organizational structures. So take us into that world for a couple of minutes. Take us into kind of where you see certain types of organizational structures work better or worse.
I think that, you know, a good analogy or a good frame of reference might be, say, the product life cycle. If you think about, you know, what it takes to extend a product, introduce a new variation, et cetera, you've got to keep doing that, otherwise a product goes away. The same is true in an organization. We all know when you're dealing with startups, and there's a ton of them here in Austin, about the only thing they care about is talent, and they want the talent now. They can do what they need to do now. They don't have time to train them, teach them, coach them, et cetera, et cetera. You know, many of these are very, very concerned about making payroll and lasting through the next quarter and that sort of thing. So clearly that means only a certain type of model or only a certain set of models, if you will, is going to work. On the other hand, I really do think the HR professional adds a tremendous degree of value when he or she looks at that and says, okay, you're past startup. You're now into the early adopter phase. You know, people are now coming back to you. You're getting referrals, et cetera, et cetera. We need to put in the right systems and systems that are lean enough to be helpful but not so burdensome that they become bureaucratic in nature. And I think that does, in fact, make you look at organizational structure as well. I'm a big fan of having fewer people than you need. I believe in the old staffing model that says, you know, the right number of people is N minus one. Fewer people by default makes you choose the important priorities, and it keeps you, I think, from getting lost around the edges when you start to work on less and less value-added activity. And that all is part of the right structure at the right time.
All right, we're going to take into account your love for the Cowboys, my love for the Cowboys. You are now appointed Chief HR Officer at the Dallas Cowboys, and you have full control. You know, here we are 3 minutes before halftime last night. It's 14-14. Chicago goes down the field at their leisure, scores a field goal. We get the ball. We completely give it back to them. Then they score a touchdown. We go into halftime, and we're down. And we never recover. I don't know if we barely even showed up. But you have full control. What is wrong with the Cowboys, and how could we fix that through the lens of HR?
You know, I think the Cowboys and the team in Washington have similar problems, and I think the problems are quite common to what I experience in the workplace. I have a client right now that has the same dynamic, if you will, and clearly that is ownership exceeding its competency boundary, if you will. And it's a challenge. You know, if you own the Dallas Cowboys or the corner convenience store, it's very challenging to have an HR professional or any other professional come in and say, you need to stay within your circle of competence. You know, Charlie Munger's famous phrase about people staying with what they know. You know, Munger said something that I think is very helpful in this context, especially relative to HR. Munger said it's not important how big your circle of competence is, and clearly he was thinking about the firms that he and Warren Buffett invest in. He said what matters is that you know where the edges are. And I think if you look at a Jerry Jones or your local C-store owner, or in the case that I'm thinking of, the founder of a professional firm, the challenge for HR is to be able to say, look, I know you're interested in growth. I know you're interested in continuing to build. The truth is you don't have confidence in these particular areas, so let the people that you hire, the good people you hire, do the work that you're paying them to do. And I'll tell you, the language that I use with clients is, hey, you're paying a lot of money to good people. Why don't you get use out of that? Let them do what you hired them to do. And it is not an easy conversation. That's true.
All right. So Jerry's the problem. Do you think Jerry will ever sell the team?
I'm sure at some point the family will. I don't know if that'll be during Jerry's lifetime. Being such a fan, I'm a little bit too biased. If I own something as meaningful, let's say, as that franchise, I wouldn't want to get rid of it. But I don't, you know, I don't demonize Jerry or anyone else. Unfortunately, and I've actually met him. He's just, you know, one of these super competent people because of his success in some areas. He hasn't really seen that he might have some limits in other areas that another professional could really help him with. And you know, it's just a challenge when you're at that level in terms of your success to date.
Yeah, it's almost like the things that have gotten him there, the very things that hold him back.
Well, yeah, and I think the analogy, I think that's a great point, yeah. I think the analogy in terms of executive leadership and executive development, and I've spent a lot of time in this area over the last 10 years or so, you know, you look at people as they migrate through any hierarchy, whether it's a very formal structured one with lots of levels or if it's a more vague one or an unprecise one where people have more leadership than role responsibility. As people move through those systems, one of the most challenging things they have to come to terms with is, hey, the activities, the behaviors, the competencies, the practices I used to get to this level in my career, to get to this point in my career, are in fact not the ones that are going to take me further. And that's really challenging. I mean, I struggle with that. It's really challenging to help somebody know you've got to let go of some things and you've got to adopt a different set of behaviors.
What's your favorite kind of leadership training or leadership development, either courses or, you know, things that you like to do and the experiences, et cetera? What's your favorite bit to do with leaders?
My favorite, and I've been doing this now for about 2 or 3 years, it just brings out an awful lot of information that you don't normally get from some of the other tools or diagnostic processes that I've seen. I love to talk about failure, and not failure in terms of personal failure or personal limitation, but I love to talk to people about, gosh, how did you circumvent a failure in your career, and what did you learn through that experience? What did other people tell you about that? What were you thinking about at the time? And if you put people together in small groups, 4 to 5 people, you'd be amazed at the things that they start to come out with. And one of the things it tells me is, A, we don't really like to talk about failure very much, but B, it's a very powerful teacher. And the people that I've seen that have embraced the learnings and haven't gotten confused with, okay, the experience was an experience, it's not me, are the ones that are able to go forward saying, all right, I can deal with ambiguity, I can deal with some setback, as long as I have a sense of what I'm really trying to achieve and how to best get others involved in that, to collaborate with that. Those are the people that tend to be more successful in the environments we face today, where the leader doesn't have all the answers, doesn't have all the information for that matter, and really needs to be able to build that collaboration and interaction with others, and in some cases, people that they don't ever see. You think about the virtual workplace, if you will.
What's the relationship in your experience between failure and values? Meaning the folks that kind of can embrace failure, talk about failure, kind of weave it into the experience, etc. Is there a relationship, I should say, between that and their value system or the company values?
Boy, that's a really good question. I would say, let me say this. The organizations that I am familiar with, either having worked in them or with them or just been very close to them through peers or colleagues, et cetera, all of those organizations have value systems that are evident. Now, those systems might or might not be close to the stated values, but I think we all understand that. The value system is evident. Successful people, and success to me is the ability to keep coming back and to keep building. You know, it's never linear. No one goes straight up. No one goes straight down. There's, you know, life throws you a lot of curves, if you will. It's a winding path. So successful people are the ones whose personal values are consistent with the organization's. And those values are fairly steady. They don't shift much, and they probably never will. But the value of a failure is in learning, call it relentlessness or persistence or perseverance. Those people are just more and more able not only to draw upon their own skills, strength, knowledge, experience, but they're able to draw others around them. And by that, I mean, I've seen some of those people stumble through product introductions or market shifts or, you know, restriction of capital, whatever it might be, and coworkers, peers, subordinates look around and say, things are pretty tough. I think I'm going to follow that person. He or she knows what's important, and they've got the perseverance and the persistence to go after it. I think we're going to make it if we follow them. And that, to me, is where values, effort, failure, and learning all come together.
So, Christopher, let's talk about technology. How does technology influence basically values and everything that we're talking about?
I missed the first part of that question.
I said, how does sorry, I must have some feedback. How does technology play into all this? How does it influence when you start talking about kind of leadership, the conversation? How does technology influence this?
I think technology is an enabler. I mean, I'm the poster child for believing in the right tools. You know, my life today exists with an iMac, an iPad, and an iPhone. As long as there's an I in front of it, I'll use it. And I'm able to deal with clients across town or across the country almost seamlessly. One of the little noticed benefits coming out of the use of technology in terms of sharing information, making sure data is accessible, et cetera, is we've largely gotten away from the traditional meeting, if you will. So nowadays, if you think about the ability to put spreadsheets or documents or presentations or photos, et cetera, into a repository and have people around the world access that repository, you don't have to have a meeting anymore to explain meaning. And I think the value of that is you're getting a lot clearer, less refined, less filtered reaction. It also certainly enables the 24-hour business, if you will. If you think about the business day more or less starting in Asia and then working its way through Europe and then finally to the Americas, you're moving business today at a much faster pace. Having the right tools in place, I think, enables the conversation. At the same time, I'm always just a little bit leery of the software as solution. To me, software is an enabler. But I don't think software is going to make a bad proposition a better proposition.
Brian, you're having trouble with your audio. Let me ask a follow-up from Christopher. Christopher, you had mentioned at the very beginning about, engagements, and I actually picked up on the fact that you used it as plural, and I wonder how often we think of culture as singular, like, our company culture and our engagement strategy, and maybe that was just a misstep in terms of you using kind of the plural, but I think of it as that way. I think of culture as plural, and I think of engagement as plural. What's give us insight into that? What's your take on culture, cultures, engagements?
Yeah, in my mind, it's not a misstep at all. One of the things that I've pushed back against fairly hard over the last year or so is this notion that I get from some parties that says, I can't do my work because my company doesn't engage me. Wait a minute. Engagement, right? Engagement, that's a group activity, folks. If you are not engaged, I cannot engage you, right? Culture is a group activity. You extend our culture. You support it. You give it meaning. You know, the things that you do, the things that you don't do, give it purpose and value. So to me, it's definitely the plural. I always ask people, what's the end game? If you want to tell me today wasn't a good day, or that meeting wasn't a good meeting, or your last GM wasn't the best GM you ever had, man, I get that. I understand that. But what's the end game? Are you going to help us? It's not a spectator sport. I always like to refer back to Ken Kesey. You're either on the bus or you're off. So if you don't like this bus, I appreciate that. I respect it. Find another one. But, hey, in this world, we're engaged, we're involved in culture, we share values. Like, this is what we're all about.
I think Brian's having all kinds of trouble with his audio. Christopher, we've got about 3 minutes left in the show, and I wanted to ask you about HR in Austin, Texas. First of all, how the hell did you get to Austin, Texas? And then give us some insight into it's the best city in Texas. In fact, I tell people that are non-Texans that actually Austin isn't a part of Texas. Houston and Dallas, absolutely a part of Texas. Austin, not a part of Texas. And I've been visiting Austin for a majority of my life. Both my brothers were born in Austin. My mom and dad married near Austin. So I don't know anything about HR in Austin, though. So tell us a little bit about recruiting and HR in Austin, Texas.
I'm in love with my city. It's true. I have lived in quite a few places in the United States. I went to four different high schools, so, you know, I had a vagabond lifestyle, that's for sure. And I've been lucky enough to do work in Asia. I've been lucky enough to to travel extensively through parts of Western Europe anyway. And, I'm one of those people, you put me down anywhere I am, I can eat the local food, I can understand the local values. I mean, I'm a world person in that sense. I got to Austin in 1981, stepped off an airplane and fell in love. I mean, I just fell in love, and I've never stopped loving my home. HR here is a fairly networked community. One of the things I do personally is try to make sure I keep up with who's who and where people are going and what the newest trends are. So it's a very active, vibrant local community, very open, people sharing ideas lots of the time, what works, what doesn't, what did we try, what are we faced with. A great deal of information exchange in terms of businesses that are growing, you know, upcoming trends, et cetera, et cetera. And an awful lot of talk about the environment in total in terms of infrastructure, housing costs, wage pressure, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the short of it is most businesses here and HR people here certainly try to ask themselves, is it good for us as an entity, but is it good for the city, for the environment? Are we making Austin a better or worse place? And that's kind of a refreshing conversation.
Nice. Well, tell us a little bit about how people can kind of keep up with you, your blog, your Twitter handle, and we'll roll out to a little music.
You can certainly follow me on Twitter, Christopher NHR, I-N-H-R. I do post quite a bit of information on LinkedIn as well. I also blog daily, same thing, Christopher NHR. So I'm pretty active in social media. Love to retweet, love to share, love to post things I find, love to get involved in some of the active chats that I see. Just love learning and love connecting with new people, and even more than that, love keeping in touch with people that I've already met. It's a wonderful time to be in HR, I got to say that.
Awesome. Well, y'all, we had a little bit of voice difficulties today, so apologies for that. Occasionally that happens. With 1,000 shows under our belt, these things happen. Christopher, it was wonderful to talk to you, A, and B, thank you for everything you do via social with, you know, adding content, curating content, sharing content, et cetera. I personally appreciate it very much. I know the ecosystem feels the same way. We're going to go on out to a little Texas band called ZZ Top. Everyone, thank you for listening to Drive Through HR, letting us invade your ear hole. Have a wonderful day. Thanks again, and thanks, Chris.
Rumors spreading around in that Texas town. About to check outside the games. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls.